If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
A big enrollment drop in the state's Medicaid program has been the talk of Jefferson City over the past few weeks. And State Representative David Wood has been intimately involved in the situation as the chairman of an appropriations subcommittee that handles health, mental health, and social services. The Versailles Republican joins us next on the latest edition of Politically Speaking to talk about the state of Missouri's Medicaid program and the prospect of Medicaid expansion.
This is Politically Speaking, the longest-running episodic podcast about Missouri politics.
It's a little complicated in Bolivar because there is a Parsons family there.
But we also knew that it was important to make sure that we got to where we needed to go.
You know, if you walk in a room and you're getting ready to make a decision and everybody in the room looks like you, you need to stop.
And right now what happens in the United States Senate is as critical as anywhere else in the country.
I really want the state to succeed.
Well, we want everybody to know that we're all working together.
I just worked hard to try to build my name where I didn't have the money.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, Jason Rosenbaum, a political correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. I'm in St. Louis today, but the other two hosts of the show are all the way in Jefferson City. We have from Jefferson City one of the co-hosts of Politically Speaking,
Julie O'Donoghue.
And making her inaugural appearance on Politically Speaking, the other co-host of Politically Speaking for today,
Jacqueline Driscoll.
Now, before we launch into our podcast with State Representative David Wood, similar to the last one we did with Representative Doug Clemens, I don't want to just launch into it without explaining to our tens and tens of listeners who you are, Jacqueline. So I want to give you a little bit of time to introduce yourself to the podcast audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your journalistic experience and what you're hoping to learn from transferring from the beautiful and immaculate state of Illinois to Missouri.
Well, I, as you mentioned, come from Illinois. I covered the State House in Springfield for our NPR affiliate there for a couple years. I focused predominantly on public health and agriculture-related policy, but there towards the end, I really extensively covered the recreational cannabis proposals that did end up passing through Illinois. And I'm excited to kind of dip my toes into Missouri cannabis. I know that medical cannabis was just passed recently, so I'm excited to dig a little deeper into that issue. Outside of my reporting experience, I have twin boys, and we just recently moved to Jefferson City, so we're learning a little bit about the state of Missouri and trying to get acclimated. We moved off the family farm, so we miss family, but everybody in Missouri has been really welcoming, and I'm excited to get moving and really meet all of the state legislators that I'll be working with throughout the legislative session.
I want Jacqueline to tell us a little bit more about, I understand, if she's willing, like she's involved with pageants.
Okay. I don't put it on my resume anymore, right? Some people have a negative connotation, but yes, I was involved in pageantry in my late teens, early 20s. I was a junior miss at a county fair, my county fair in Henry County, and then I came back, was the Miss Henry County Fair, and then I was the first Miss Henry County Fair to go on and win the Miss Illinois County Fair. So what's different about the county fair pageant system is it's heavily focused in agriculture. I'm a sixth generation descendant on my family farm, so agriculture has always been an important part of my life growing up. And I just got to expand my communication skills. I got to expand, you know, my networking system. And, you know, as people can portray pageant girls, I like to say that I'm not one of them and that pageant girls should have a different connotation because we learn a lot of great skills and they're some of the women that I admire most. So I learned a lot. Love the system, but I'm happy that I'm an adult in the State House now and not having to wear high heels every day.
Did it help you with like your broadcast skills and stuff like that? I mean, I agree. I think we need to take pageant women seriously, mm-hmm. you know.
Yes, it did. I actually went to school in my undergraduate program to be a high school history teacher. And I was. For a year, after my year of service as Miss Illinois County Fair Queen, I went on to teach in the classroom. And I just didn't love it. So that's kind of what inspired me to get involved into journalism and broadcast. I started off as a sports reporter. That's what I initially wanted to go into the master's program as. But now I'm just reporting in a different arena in politics. But yeah, I definitely think that it helped not only like with interviewing skills, but just being able to confidently walk through the state house, knowing that I am an intelligent person, and it definitely translates into my work.
I know you've only been in Missouri for a few weeks, and we've had some of these offline conversations about the difference between the Illinois legislature and the Missouri legislature. But from learning about the differences and maybe talking with people, what are some of the big things that you've noticed about the Missouri legislature so far that are different than Illinois? And more than just the obvious question that Illinois' legislature is controlled by Democrats and Missouri's is controlled by Republicans.
Well, I've answered this question, I feel, you know, five times different ways, but that is a big part of it, right? When Illinois' legislature is heavily Democratic, right? We have a Democratic governor with a supermajority Democrats in the legislature here in Missouri, all Republican. So we see a lot of the same issues, or I have, right? When we talked about the abortion issue, Missouri was kind of downsizing, right? We passed that 8-week ban. And then in Illinois, we saw Illinois expanding it as a constitutional right. So I'm seeing a lot of the same issues are important because they are Midwestern states. And I think, you know, our general makeup, we're going to have a lot of the same issues, but the chips kind of fall a different way with how the legislature is stacked up. Here within the state house, I mean, I obviously haven't been through a legislative session, but I can already tell that there are a lot of different rules. Jason, you've kind of filled me in on the filibuster for one. There's no filibuster.
I was going to say, I can't believe there's not a strong filibuster in Illinois. And by a strong filibuster, I mean like you stand up, you talk for 24 hours, and you can block or force changes in legislation. That's like a shocking, even though I lived in Illinois for 18 years, and I probably should have known that, like that was legitimately shocking for me to learn that wasn't in the Illinois Senate.
Definitely. And, you know, I can't say that I was mad about it, hearing about all these reporters sleeping on our couch here in the office, you know, as filibusters go all night long. I'm a little nervous about that, right? Can I hang with the best of them? But I will do my best. Also, the very strange rule that, Jason, you'll have to correct me, but is it in both the House and the Senate or just the Senate that legislators cannot move if they're in the middle of a debate?
I think it's both, but I think it's especially problematic in the Senate, given that there are fewer members. And if you are entrenched in a filibuster and you really want to go do something else and you're in that line of debate, just play Angry Birds for 7 hours because you're not going anywhere. So.
Right. And, you know, the final thing that I've noticed here in the Illinois State House, I was in the basement, so I only had one flight of stairs. And here we're up in the attic, so I got five flights. So I'll have better legs, I guess, as I move through the state house.
So I'm wondering, I suspect it might be the same for Jacqueline, but I covered the Louisiana legislature, and I've noticed that legislators here are a lot younger than the ones I covered. The speaker is 37. I think the speaker back, the one I covered, was probably over 60 years old. I hope I'm getting that right, Speaker Barra. And then, like, what was the other thing I was going to say? That's a big difference, and that's probably due to term limits. But for me, it was like everyone was an older person, and having seen a few legislators at the Illinois-Missouri softball game that got rained out, it seems like the legislators in Missouri might be a lot younger on average.
I think in Illinois, we had a large presence of younger people, but we also did have those institutional people that have been there for years. I mean, everyone in Illinois knows Mike Madigan, the buzzword, right? Speaker Mike Madigan, who's been there forever. But we've also had a lot of turnover recently where we're seeing those younger people coming in, and I think that's just due to the political climate. But I am really excited about what term limits brings in our coverage, right? Because in Illinois, I think, you know, people that had that institutional knowledge and people that had been there forever didn't always make themselves available to the press. And I think people here with the term limits, and they're only here for a short amount of time, and they want to get what they want accomplished, and they don't have forever to do it. I'm hoping that, you know, presents a different opportunity for as a reporter.
Well, thank you, Jacqueline, for introducing yourself. And after this quick break, we'll have our interview with State Representative David Wood, a Republican from Versailles, Missouri, and we'll hear from him right after this break.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
And Jacqueline and I are back with State Representative David Wood. So before we start talking about the Medicaid program in Missouri, Representative Wood, tell us a little bit about yourself, what your district encompasses, and how you got involved in the weird and wacky world of Missouri politics.
Well, that can be a very long story. I'm a retired school teacher. I started out in education in Versailles. I did that for 25 years. I was in the classroom teaching upper-level math classes and computer classes, physics. When you're in a small school district, you also coach all three sports. You drive a school bus. You do all kinds of things. So it was one of those interesting experiences. It really broadened my horizons, but it worked out extremely well for me. Then after I retired in 2008, I went to work for a hospital here in Jefferson City in the IT department, which gave me a lot of experience across the different spectrums of healthcare because I was working with doctors, nurses, billing, scheduling, in the clinics, in the hospital itself, with administration. So I got to work very closely with a lot of different people and make a lot of good connections. Then in 2012, I decided to run for the Missouri House, and my district is House District 58. It encompasses all of Morgan County, most of Montague County, and part of Miller County. So it's a very diverse district. So I have lake property, I have agriculture, I have a little bit of industry, a lot of miles of highways, and so I get to deal with tourism, which is a great asset for the state of Missouri, our number two industry, and I deal with agriculture as being the number one. Morgan County's number one poultry producing county in the state, so we're very, very active. But also by having my district with the Lake of the Ozarks, in the summertime I represent probably 150,000 people instead of 37,000. Because when you own a home on the lake, you don't call your hometown representative to have issues with docks and boats and those types of things. So it's a very interesting district and one I'm very, very proud of. I got into politics. I will be honest and say that a superintendent many, many years ago asked me to run when I was looking at retiring. I looked at it then in 2008. My district didn't lay very well for me. I didn't have a lot of connections. But with the redistricting in 2012, I had taught and worked in Morgan County since 1983. I grew up in Eldon, which is that part of Miller County, and my family is still there. And so I had to meet a lot of people in Montague County. But it laid out very well for me, and I decided to run. Been very grateful ever since. It's a wonderful job. I've been able to have an influence in education and healthcare. I'm a numbers person, so working in budget has been very beneficial for me. And it really shows you what the state does. When you look at that $30 billion and how it's spent, you know where the priorities really are.
So in terms of Medicaid and the Missouri Health Net, what's the latest? I know that the speaker requested more information from Missouri Health Net. Have you received any information?
Well, I've been getting updates for the last several months. I get a daily chart. In fact, I brought it with me just so we can have it as a reference of how many people are enrolled in Medicaid every month and see what the changes have been. Now, there's a lot of different reasons for enrollment changes. I had gone up about 120,000 individuals during the time that the Affordable Care Act was putting a requirement on every individual to go to the exchange and enroll in health insurance. Because when you went to the exchange and you enrolled in health insurance and your children qualified for Medicaid, you were required to put them on Medicaid. So we gained 120,000. When you look at the numbers, starting in November of 2014, we had about 540,000 kids on Medicaid. That grew to 635,000, 640,000 children on Medicaid. And now we're starting to see that decline back down because the requirement's no longer there. When the federal government removed the penalty on the taxes, then you don't have to do that anymore. So as that began in 2019, so the enrollments in 2018, if I'm on Medicaid, I'm having to pay a premium on CHIP, or if my income has moved me up to a premium, I can say, no, I'm not going to do that. I can put my children on my own insurance, or there's the bad scenario that the parents may make the choice not to insure their children.
Do you think that that accounts for that significant drop in enrollment, though? I mean, 95,000 kids, that's a lot of kids coming off.
Well, it's also when you added 120,000 kids because of the requirement to take 95,000 off isn't that big a difference.
What's the incentive for parents, though, to take off their kids?
Well, one, if you were especially moving from full Medicaid, which is 0% to 150% of the poverty level, if I had gotten an increase, if my pay had increased and moved me up to where I was into CHIP, you have to pay a premium for the insurance under CHIP. It can go from very, very small to up to 5% of your income. So now, if I wanted to put them on my policy, which could very potentially be cheaper than what CHIP is, the coverage won't be as good, but you could go to a high deductible, have a lower premium, or if you take that terrible risk of saying my children are healthy and I don't want to put them on insurance, you could make that option.
Based on the information that you have received or that you have been getting over the course of a couple of months, I know that the speaker also said he's open to legislative investigations or hearings if they're necessary. Do you feel that those hearings might be held?
It depends on the numbers. If they continue to drop and we get below where we were for years, starting in March of 2013, we up until November of 2014, we stayed between 520,000 to 540,000 children on Medicaid. Then you start putting in the ACA, and we stayed in a range of 610,000 to 635,000 right up until the change in the ACA. Then it starts dropping off about 10,000 a month. And the reason it goes by month is you cycle through your renewals. So you would, if your renewal come up in the month of January, that 1/12th of the population would have the choice to reduce or not. And each month you get that choice. Now, as this cycles through and we've gone through a complete year now, those numbers should start leveling off at about the 510 to 530,000 that we had to beforehand. And that's about where we're at right now. We're at 527,043 in the month of June.
If we do, just speaking hypothetically, if we do still see numbers dropping and we decide to hold these hearings, do you think that that's going to be enough? Is the problem going to resolve quick enough for people?
Well, I don't know that we can resolve the problem until we find the problem. I can tell you that I am in constant contact with the director of Medicaid. Todd Richardson and I talk two or three times a week, especially over this issue. We've talked to Patrick Lubring, the director of the Division of Family Services, because they are in charge of MEDIS, the program that actually does the enrollment, to see what numbers we can pull and try and find out exactly who we're losing. I can also tell you, there is the economy, because it is improving. Salaries are increasing. We have more people employed. You're going to find more people falling to where they're not qualifying for the program, or they're moving to a spot in the program they want to go to their own insurance. You have to look at the whole picture and what has changed and what hasn't changed. Our requirements for enrollment So what it takes to qualify for Medicaid for children has not changed. We didn't do it statutorily. The department hasn't made any changes. The enrollment process has changed. The new program that started in April or May of 2018 is doing a better job of certifying that those that are enrolled in Medicaid should be in Medicaid. So it's not kicking out people that do belong on Medicaid, but if you have an income that's raised, we weren't doing a very good job of catching that very quickly. So now we're doing a better job, and those people are being moved off of Medicaid if they don't qualify. So your factor that changes is the program, the economy, the change in the ACA. Who we're allowing in or the rules that qualify these children for Medicaid have not changed. So it's not a problem in what we've changed or we're throwing people off. We can't throw people off that qualify. So, and those rules haven't changed. So our numbers should stay basically the same as they were before these variables kicked in.
So in listening to all of this, you've given me examples of different variables. It sounds like we don't see a big red flag, or you're not seeing a big red flag for these people coming off.
I'm not seeing a big red flag.
Okay.
I see a flag that gives me concern and a reason for the department and myself and those with oversight of Medicaid to make sure that we're not doing something wrong, or if we have a glitch that we need to get it fixed. But I can tell you that there has been problems in enrollment in the past with Medicaid. It's been 3 or 4 years ago, and we had an issue, and I was getting phone calls daily from my constituents saying, my renewal was denied, my income's the same, I don't know why it would happen. And I would call the department, we would go through, we'd find those issues, correct them, and then 24 hours later, they would have it fixed. And we got that corrected fairly quickly. I have not had a single phone call from my district from a parent saying my children have been taken off of Medicaid and I still qualify. So I don't think it's something that we're doing that's an issue with the program. And the other piece of this is, if it was a problem with the program and my child still qualified for Medicaid, went to the hospital, they could put in and bill Medicaid, and if they qualified, Medicaid's going to pay because the enrollment would have gone back to the application date and 3 months prior. So we're not taking coverage away. And if parents are making the choice not to cover their children, when they go to the hospital with an issue, they'll reapply. It will go to that date and 3 months prior. The coverage will be there, but the hospitals would see a delay in their payment.
In talking about those constituent calls, are we for sure that parents or even people that might be removed from Medicaid, the rolls, would be aware of this issue, or might they find that out when
they're seeking coverage? They do a yearly re-enrollment and a recertification. So those that are on Medicaid are very aware of the process. And if they were denied, they would be given a letter with a reason as to why they were denied and given an opportunity to reapply or to appeal. So it's not like they don't know that their children are losing coverage. They're notified and given every opportunity to correct it.
And you mentioned, I just want to go back, you mentioned about speaking to the Medicaid director, Todd Richardson. I am new, so I've been trying to do my homework the best I can, but I do know that he didn't have experience in the healthcare arena before he was appointed by Governor Parson. Are we confident in his capability to manage the situation?
Yeah, I have known Todd for quite some time as being Speaker of the House, Majority Floor Leader, working with him as a representative. And I can tell you there are very few people in the state that have the abilities of Todd Richardson. If there is any one person who can bring a consensus to Medicaid and getting all the players to the table to come up to solutions, I believe it's him. His learning curve for Medicaid has been very, very steep, but he has attacked it and learned faster than anybody possibly imagined he could. So he has a very good grasp of the situation. He's getting a plan in place to reform Medicaid and make significant changes as to the way we pay, which is very necessary and needed. We have one of the most complicated Medicaid systems in the country, partly because we do part managed care, which is basically insurance for our children. And then we do fee-for-service, where the state pays the bill for all of our age, blind, disabled, our mental health patients, So I use this crazy example that if I move to the state of Missouri and I have my grandchildren, I qualify for Medicaid, and I call Medicaid and I say, hey, I've got my grandchildren, I've moved here. They said, well, and I qualify for Medicaid. They said, well, great, you're on fee for service, but your grandchildren are going to be in managed care. So, okay, we've got some counseling issues, some psychological issues with moving. We're going to have to see a psychiatrist. Well, that's fine, but it's not going to be under managed care. It's going to fall under fee for service. Well, when I go to the pharmacy and get their drugs, is that going to be fee for service or managed care? Well, pharmacy's carved out. So that's managed care. But if they go to the doctor for a cold, that's under pharmacy's fee for service, but the cold is managed care. It's so complicated in the way we bill and have constructed things. We desperately need reform in the way this is done.
Has there been any discussions you've had with Speaker Richardson to convert Medicaid into entirely managed care or entire fee for service? I know that's been a very big hot button issue over the last 5 years, especially with a lot of private companies that want to enter the managed care space. Is that something that you've talked with Speaker Richardson about?
Yes, we've had that discussion, especially when he first became the director for Medicaid. And I think there would be some advantages, in especially in our hardware and software programming, to go to managed care. But I don't know that that's the best solution. And we've got a lot of resistance. It's going to take a lot of work to try and get a compromise to that. But that being said, I think he is looking more to a totally different way of looking at things besides the issue of managed care fee for service, but more in how we're reimbursing our participants or our providers, putting a qualification of results on there. So if I'm a doctor and I have excellent results and I'm getting paid through Medicaid, we ought to give you a little bit more money because you're doing an excellent job as to someone who may not be performing quite so well. And most of his focus has been on that value-based pricing and payment structure. And that actually can go through both fee-for-service and managed care. We have some issues with our hardware and software under fee-for-service. The system was bought back in the 1980s. There's very few people that can even work on it. Making programming changes is difficult. So we're also having to look at what software changes we can make so we can actually get to a point we can look at some of these reforms. So it's more than just the question of managed care versus fee-for-service. It's really in how we deal with our limitations, with our objectives, and trying to get the best product we can.
And kind of in that same ballpark, we know that the state is losing hundreds of millions of dollars that they could be getting from the federal government if Medicaid were to be expanded. We know, as you mentioned, Medicaid already takes up a massive part of our budget, and being fiscally responsible is always important. But is foregoing those federal dollars really the best decision?
Well, it depends on how you want to do your math here, because it's not 100% reimbursement on all of those individuals coming in new. It's going to be 90%, 10%. So if we expand Medicaid, we're still on the hook for 10% of that bill. And we have to expand our resources and spend more money to cover that. Yes, it is getting health care coverage for 100% of the population from 138% of poverty on down. I think that's something we're going to be discussing, because an initiative petition most likely is going to hit the ballot. We're going to have to look at what that means for the state of Missouri. But for right now, the idea that it saves us or gets us money is probably a misconception, because to get that 90% money, you have to pay 10% of the bill.
Okay. So I know that you're in a rural district. Again, mm-hmm. kind of help my politics team help me help me do some homework, but between the lack of Medicaid expansion and the closure of rural hospitals, do you see a connection there?
There is a lot of connection between the closing of rural hospitals and basically the payment of Medicaid and the services that can be offered. Medicaid pays the lowest of the three. So if you're a high Medicaid population, Medicare pays number two. So if you look at what the cost of a procedure is, 30 to 35% of that cost of the procedure is reimbursed by Medicaid. If you go to Medicare, you're getting 65, maybe 70%. And to help offset the cost, they charge insurance companies and private pay over 100% to help cover some of that. So if you're a rural hospital that's heavy on Medicaid and heavy on Medicare, very little private pay or insurance, then yes, you can have some issues. You also look at billing. Independent doctors are very hard to come by anymore. They're almost all associated with a hospital. And that's partly because of the billing complications that go through Medicaid and Medicare. We need to keep our rural hospitals. It's definitely important for the distance. I have to travel a minimum of 50 minutes to get to a hospital, whether being in Versailles, it's either Bothwell in Sedalia, or go down to Lake Regional at Osage Beach, or to come up to Jefferson City to St. Mary's or Capital Region. That's a pretty good time frame when you're in a dire straits.
Healthcare is confusing, to say the least. It's hard to talk about. It's also complicated, but it's also incredibly important. So when we're seeing these enrollment drops, when we talk about the closure of these rural hospitals, where do we go from here? How do we remedy some of the issues that we see that are prevalent in healthcare?
Well, I think we have to look at some of the reforms that Director Richardson is looking at. And the hospitals are very supportive of this. So if I'm a rural hospital and I'm doing a good job and I'm serving a community, then I can draw an extra payment out of Medicaid because of my service. That's a good thing for them and an encouragement for them. I think you will see more consolidations. We've had the big discussion with the University of Missouri Healthcare possibly taking over St. Mary's in both Jefferson City and Audrain. I personally think that would be a very good move for multiple reasons. And St. Mary's is very anxious for the deal. There is some resistance here in Jefferson City. But that consolidation makes sense because then you would have MU Healthcare, Capital Region Medical Center, Lake Regional Hospital, and SSM all on the same platform, the same health records. So if you went to any one of their clinics or any one of their hospitals, your medical records would follow you because they're all affiliated with the University of Missouri. So there are some advantages to that. Hopefully that deal can come through next year. We're going to have to do a little bit of legislative work, I believe, and I hopefully the negotiations are continuing. But there can be advantages to small hospitals being taken over by the larger entities because they're easier to absorb some of those costs and get specialists. One of the things you run into is child centers or birthing obstetrics because that's a very expensive thing to have. And to put it into a rural hospital where you're going to see very few patients, to have those doctors on call 24 hours for deliveries, for critical issues, is very difficult to do. So you end up going to the larger hospitals anyway. But if the larger hospital can rotate doctors through and they can be all part of the same system, then it's a little easier to absorb.
You mentioned the Medicaid expansion ballot initiative, which I've seen some social media traffic seems to be getting a little bit more attention from people that support that concept. My question for you is, would the legislature consider actually taking up the issue of Medicaid expansion and kind of put its own stamp on how to pay for that 10% state cost? Because I mention this because in the last couple of election cycles, we've seen a number of initiative petitions go through, and you with medical marijuana, with the campaign donation limits of 2016, with some of the things in Clean Missouri, which I understand is constitutional and the legislature can't really do anything anyways. But a lot of legislators have regretted not doing something, and then this ballot initiative goes through and the state pretty much has to deal with the parameters of that. I understand it's a long windup for a relatively simple question of, is the legislature going to do something on that issue? But I'd like to hear your opinion on that.
Well, if it gets to be a ballot initiative, chances are it's going to be a constitutional amendment, not a statutory thing that we could possibly change, which could cause problems on its own. So if you get very detailed in what this Medicaid expansion is going to be and you put it into the Constitution, any change that would be made to that then would have to be done on a ballot proposition. So if you wanted to change the level of enrollment in Medicaid from 138 to 150, you would have to go to the voters. You couldn't do that as a legislature. So I'm hoping that whatever ballot initiative goes through, that it's going to be statutory, not constitutional. Or if it is constitutional, that it's very vague so we can have the parameters that we're able to change and design that to actually fit the state of Missouri. It's a long road to see what that initiative is actually going to be and what makes it to the ballot. But I don't know that putting something through in the legislature now at this late a time would be preemptive on that ballot initiative coming up next year.
Do you think that if that ballot initiative gets enough signatures, I'm kind of getting the sense from hearing you that you think that it would pass if it went statewide. Is that fair to say, or do you think that it may not pass if there's like a strong opposition campaign against it?
You know, I am absolutely the wrong person to ask that question. I would have said that a gas tax to improve our roads probably would have passed pretty easily and that we would never, ever pass medical marijuana. My prediction on what the ballot initiatives come through with has been very, very bad. It all depends on how much money is spent on both sides of that campaign and how it's presented. So if you're giving the people the option of health care for everyone, which we heard in the Democrat debates last night over and over again, then there was even some resistance to that by the middle of the road. But if you offer someone something that they're going to see as no cost and helpful to them, then yes, they typically vote for it. So I'm not sure how it will go with the population centers in St. Louis and Kansas City. I'm sure it will be a popular item. It will probably be less popular in the rural communities because we tend to be a little more conservative.
You are the vice chairman of the House Budget Committee going into your last couple of years. How would you describe this?
Last one. Let's not extend it any more than I have to.
Well, thank you for pointing that out. I didn't want to give you like mega term limits. That would be good. That would be unfair to you. I mean, there was some early rumblings, I guess, and I think this may have been for the current budget year, FY 2020, that the revenues weren't going to meet up with the budgetary needs. But it seemed like there was a last minute surge of tax filings in April, and it seems like the budget is in decent shape from the outside looking in. You're somebody who is from the inside looking in. I wanted you to spend a couple minutes talking about what you think the state of the Missouri budget is with that as a backdrop.
Well, as the fiscal year ended, we ended pretty much where we had predicted with the consensus revenue estimate. Our finances, we had actually spent less than what we had budgeted, so we had a little bit of a reserve sitting there as well. So I think the finances for the state of Missouri are in very good shape right now. The shortfall that was coming is partly because of the withholding. With the Department of Revenue, they hadn't updated the tables correctly. Employers were not withholding the amount of money properly from paychecks. So we had more people owing money to the state or having refunds be less this year. So you wouldn't see that change until April when the tax forms were due. So from April through May, when people had paid their taxes and waited to the last day to file, we saw that increase come in and it all balanced out in the final numbers. So in terms of revenue for the state, I don't think we're looking at cuts. We're not looking at withholdings. So in the budget that we did for the next year, and we had shortfalls and real problems, you would have seen the governor come out with withholdings already to make sure that we didn't spend more than we took in. And there's no concern for that right now.
My understanding, and I've read some other articles about this, because the revenue numbers, I guess, aren't where they needed to be, is there not that the tax cuts that I think were passed in 2014 or 2015, are they not going to go into effect this year because they didn't hit the revenue benchmarks? Or have you heard anything about that?
That's not quite right, I don't believe, because we did pass a second tax cut bill sponsored by Speaker of the House Elijah Haar that next year should reduce it down from 5.9% down to 5.5% as your tax rate, but it eliminates the exemption for the federal taxes that you pay. So it's a little bit more of a revenue neutral tax cut. We're watching the numbers because you had to hit $150 million in additional revenue from the previous year to kick in the other tax cut, which would have brought it from 5.9 down to 5.8, and then Representative Haar's would have taken it to 5.4 instead of 5.5. I believe, of course, the budget office is going to have to do the final calculations because there's several factors that I don't see. But I believe we're not going to hit the $150 million increase, so it's going to be going down to 5.5 for the following year.
And that goes into effect like in 2020 or for the 2020 tax year. Okay, this is why I ask these questions, because sometimes I legitimately don't know. You mentioned transportation, and I know that transportation spending tends to be different from other things in the budget because a lot of it is paid for with like a direct tax, like gas taxes and diesel taxes, and a lot of the money gets divvied out by MoDOT, which is not under the auspices of the legislature. But there was a legislative move this year for bonding, which does include, I guess, some general revenue dollars that I guess amounts to a down payment on the governor's bridge plan. In year seven of your legislative service, have you ever seen general revenue directed toward transportation like that? And if not, what do you think it means going forward for the legislature's involvement in transportation issues? Because, again, from the outside looking in, it does seem like a paradigm shift on an issue that a lot of people have a lot of concern about.
And there was a lot of concern with that in the legislature. Yes, this is the first time that we've used general revenue to subsidize the road programs and MoDOT. But it kind of is one of those things that you have to invest in infrastructure. If we do not fix our bridges, we do not fix our roads, we're going to end up in a much worse shape than we are right now. And right now, the bridge at Roachport was the focus, because if you do a repair on that and you back up traffic, you slow people going across I-70, and it's only going to last 4 to 5 years before you have to do something else, or you can build next to it. With the additional money now that we got from the federal government, plus the bonding, plus the $100 million that we put in, now we're able to build to the side, replace the bridge, not interrupt traffic flow on I-70. So there are some very strong reasons that that money was added in. But it also had a condition on it that the federal money that was just recently approved had to make it into the budget, or we didn't spend our bonding and general revenue money. So it all fell into place. Thank goodness that we're going to be able to repair some of these bridges and keep people safe. We have more road miles and more bridges than most of the states around us. And in fact, some people say you can combine the states around us and not have as many road miles as we do. So it's very important for us to invest in our transportation infrastructure. If you start looking at the number of interstates and I-70 coming across and the amount of traffic it has and the business that brings to the state of Missouri, we can't afford not to have that.
My final question for you, this is, as you mentioned, 2020 will be your last year in the Missouri House. What are some general goals that you want to accomplish before you run as far away from the Missouri Capitol as you possibly can and never come back?
Well, I don't know that I'm running completely away from the Missouri Capitol. I just know that I'm not going to be running for an elected office. I have given a lot of tours of the Capitol, so maybe I can get a job as a tour guide down at the front desk and still stay in the building. You know, my focus all the years that I've been here has really been on child care and child safety. I think that's extremely important. We've developed some programs. We expanded home visiting to go statewide for Children's Division this year. We've expanded the community health workers that will go out and actually improve the way we're spending our Medicaid dollars. I would love to see health homes expanded because that's a better use of our dollars and more efficient. Plus, we're getting better services to our constituents. I will stay extremely involved in the budget. I dabble in education once in a while. I'm trying to stay away from that a little bit. But if there was an issue that came up that was extremely important to me with schools, I would be right on the bandwagon. So in my last year, I try not to carry more than 4 or 5 bills in the 7 years I've been here so I can focus and really put my energy on those bills. And I've had fairly good success. Most of them don't have my name on them, but they've become law. So I'll stay focused and trying to pass on some of this to the freshman class. We've got 61 new members that are very eager to learn. They're doing a great job, but they don't have the institutional knowledge. So the more time they spend with those of us that are seniors and getting a little bit of that history, I think it's very important for us to pass that along.
Well, Representative, thank you so much for coming on the program. For all of our stories, stlpublicradio.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you on Twitter, Jacqueline?
It is at DriscollNPR.
And how could people follow you on Twitter, Representative Wood, or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
At Rep District 58. And, of course, my email address at my office is david.wood@house.mo.gov, or you can go to the Facebook page, send me a friend request. I'd love to have you. It's an honor to serve the people of the state of Missouri, and especially my district, which I'm very proud of. So vacation at Lake of the Ozarks. Come spend your money. Enjoy the number one recreational lake in the state of Missouri. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Until next time, so long.